Greetings and welcome to Edgy Ideas, the podcast that explores what it means to live the good life and create the good society in our disruptive age. My name is Simon Western, and I will be talking to invited guests about diverse topics, exploring social conscious and unconscious dynamics and desires. Welcome to this episode of Edgy Ideas. Today we're going to be speaking to guest Richard Claydon. Richard lives in Hong Kong. He's originally from Australia, and his work is full of daring and imagination, a touchstone for the future of management and organization. Richard's currently on our course, Analytic Network Coaching Training. We've got to know each other, and his work is very much about the future of organizations, and he's particularly interested in irony and absurdity. Richard, you're very welcome to Edgy Ideas. How are you doing?
I'm very well, Simon. Thanks for inviting me on.
Tell us something about why work is absurd. Let's start there, Richard.
We're stuck in an era where lots of theories from 100 odd years ago, which weren't really based on much other than intuitive ideas, are playing out their end games. We've got an awful lot of people who have a deep contextual understanding of the work they do who are being surrounded by all of these theories that really are either bad interpretations of the original ideas or pretty scientifically dodgy or snake oily in the first place. And so all these guys on the ground, and this is my experience again, what on earth is going on here? What are people thinking when they put these models in place? Normally under the term best practice, and actually it talks to nothing to what we're doing. It's completely alien to the work that needs to be done. And then it's the response to that what the hell moment that I'm interested in. And of course there are numerous different responses to that, but it's that work shouldn't be this absurd, should it? Oh, it is. Now what do I do about it?
So that's probably why you and I are both independents, working outside the organizations.
Very probably, yes.
Yeah. No, and that's my experience as well. I mean, I'm always kind of surprised about how society and workplaces have been, at one level, very successful. I mean, economies have grown and one level there's been a huge success. And when you actually go into organizations, the amount of dysfunction we see and the absurdity we see, it's hard to reconcile that, although it does explain the other catastrophe around the environmental crisis and stuff, how we've not paid attention to so many things and how many people suffer under this these absurd systems as well.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, and I'm, you know, I think it's easier to see the external suffering, but I also think there's a huge amount of internal suffering. I mean, and I think, you know, the COVID pandemic crisis, whatever you want to call it, is bringing to the center of attention some of this internal suffering again. So again, one of the responses to this ongoing absurdity and the inability to resolve it, and the fact that it you're getting more and more you're supposed to be doing and more work and there's no out in terms of for lots of people, is this sort of, well, I'm fading out, I'm burning out, I'm breaking down, yeah. I can't cope with this anymore. So we are seeing, I think, and I hope, the beginnings of a movement to put well-being back into the center of the organization, the core of the organization. And I am, for the first time in my life, working with a client who takes that incredibly seriously. So to put well-being at the center, and then out of having employees that are feeling well in all aspects of their being, good work emerges. So yeah. I mean, there's a little bit of cynicism. So the same as there was greenwashing going on in the sustainability movement, and it's still going on, but there's a bit more seriousness about it, and some organisations are recognising that sustainable practices are actually have bottom line impacts, important bottom line impacts. I think well-being is about the same space. There's a lot of well-washing going on. There's also the beginnings of organisations who are recognising, you know what, if our employees who we're hiring to do pretty complex work in lots of organisations nowadays are not particularly well physically, emotionally, cognitively or spiritually, we have a bit of a problem getting the work done. It's been a pleasure to finally have an organization who's sort of said, no, well-being central, and let's go from there.
Yeah, because I work with coaches and people in the well-being space, and often they feel like they're kind of field medics, like patching people up and putting them back into the craziness, into the absurdity, and patching them up to make them more resilient so they can cope with more absurdity, and that's like the opposite of what you're talking about, isn't it? It's about a completely different rationale.
Well, I mean, again, so this begins to go into the way we look at how people respond to this ongoing absurdity and the increasing demands for good work around it. So, be more productive, be higher performing, etc. Two terms we would use is, if you're falling into the space that you're talking about, you're beginning to suffer fragmented intelligence. And so the early stages of that is sort of the fade out moment where you look back at your emails and say, that doesn't sound like me, or I've made some spelling mistakes, or you become a bit more irritated with somebody, or you forget something, or there's all these little signs. And then if you talk to someone who's really beginning to suffer, the people I have spoken to, they actually say, look, it's not I didn't just feel like myself, I was no longer myself.
That
it was a full fragmentation, and the self that they became was different from the self that they thought they were. So there was at least a fragmentation into two different versions of self, and they didn't know how to put it back together again. So what you're talking about there is, how do you patch such people up? So in the war field, you put a bandage around their legs, but we're talking about putting a bandage around their brains and getting them back into battle again. So I'm personally don't do much of that work, although I'm hoping, with your coaching, I might be able to, or your coaching advice, I might. But I have a bunch of people who specialize in that space that I work with. I'm much more interested in what I would call the level above, which I think is the condition of the vast majority of the organizations. And we would say that's when you're using dramatic intelligence. So you're in this political arena. And if you dramatically display how well you're working, and the display of how well you're working might not correspond with how well you're actually working, they could be very different things. But you're displaying evidence according to the metrics and according to the visuals that you're doing a good job, and you're playing the political game. Now you can be ruthless, Machiavellian, or you can be a Lomac, and there's different ways. I'm not saying this is a bad thing, but you're playing that dramatic game in that level. And some people are really good at it, and not only are really good at it, really enjoy it. Fluidly just move through that kind of situation. So they've got chances of being more productive, or at least looking more productive, of getting promotions. But a lot of people find it really difficult. It feels like having two jobs. So we're sort of back to at least two jobs, maybe as many as seven or eight, where you've got all these different audiences expecting different things of you, which begins to pull you into that fragmented space. Because you're like, how do I perform to this audience? And how do I perform to that audience? And suddenly you've got two audiences in front of you needing different performances. Yeah. And you're starting to feel, you're under this constant pressure. This is more than one job. This is two jobs. I've got to stop knives being stuck in my back. I've got to do this and I've got to do that. So you, within that space that I'm focused on, where we're talking about a dramatic form of intelligence, the art of playing the role that needs to be played, or the roles that need to be played. How do you prevent people from slipping into the fragmented space?
Isn't the fragmented space part of the postmodern condition? How do you reconcile the postmodern condition? It is the loss of the grand narrative, the fragmented, the bricolage. And that sounds very much about how you're describing the workplace. And how do you work with the fact that we're in that space? Are you trying to move back to a kind of more modern, unified space, a more holistic, or is it something else you're looking at?
So I think I'm looking at going into, a slightly more a shared consciousness space. I mean, I wouldn't call myself spiritual, but there's something spiritual in the movement that we're trying to create.
Yes.
So what we're really looking at is if dramatic intelligence and fragmented intelligence are both relatively draining for the majority of people, and in fact fragmented intelligence is draining for all people.
Yes.
What kinds of work create energy or purpose, mm-hmm. or some kind of meaning? And we would regard, you know, being productive, knowing you're being productive, you know, going back into the pure Marxian sense, sort of I'm productive, I understand my productivity, I'm owning my productivity. And you know how you have coherence into how that productivity has impact in your organization, yes, and preferably the world. Yes. You know, that's one level of energy. And I think in that productivity level, you're moving, you know, there's times you're in flow. And of course, that feels amazing. It's you know, all of the energy and it's fabulous. But there's also times of frustration where you're struggling to work out solutions. But then what I'm really then interested in is the more collective shared intelligences at the top. So we talk about collective intelligence. You know, how do you actually get shared consciousness at a level of the team? I think I'm talking about collective intelligence. And then we talk about extended intelligence, which is a shared consciousness beyond the boundaries of the organization. How do you draw everything that could be drawn in into your organizational experience in order to contribute, A, to your own personal good and those who are working with you, B, to the organizational good, but also to societal and global good. So that's really how we try and separate the work. And what we find is, yeah, we find that people don't understand the difference between the levels of employing dramatic intelligence, individual intelligence, the productive level, and collective intelligence. But they sort of respond to it when you start explaining it to them. Yeah. So if you can get out of the dramatic and into the collective, really interesting things will start happening.
This is exactly the space I'm working in with my eco leadership. So we talk about the ecosystems, organizations being ecosystems, within ecosystems being technological ecosystems, environmental ecosystems, social and people ecosystems, and talk about kind of how you connect to those. And I mean, my experience is people get that at a cognitive level, and then when you try and drill down in the workplace to engage with that, they really struggle and they revert back to kind of old paradigms, old ways of thinking. And holding them in that space is a struggle I have. How do you kind of work with that?
This is where you're going into the stuff, and irony is the response.
Yeah.
So the work I've done sort of suggests that there are always people in an organization who can hold that space and who are holding that space. Mm-hmm. What you're trying to do is find them and make them part of whatever team you're working with. So it's not just you as the agitator, you've got others that are. And so I'll sort of describe why they surfaced in the work that we did, because we were doing, so I was part of a multidisciplinary research team working in an Australian steelworks, and you know, there's not many research projects that have ever happened at this level. We had unfettered access for 6.5 years on site, plus another 7 years of research afterwards, where we were looking through the data. And my sort of job was, because it was so multidisciplinary, we had academics from all kinds of disciplines, and they'd all identified this character type that was poking fun at the company, poking fun at the managers, poking fun at the academics, poking fun at themselves, knew everything about the organization. Everybody liked working with them. And so that was what we called the ironic sensibility. And my role was to really theorize what was going on there. And then post the research was how do you find them and use them? And it's not just my work. There's a lot of different terms for these characters dotted through the literature. But the aim is, okay, how do you find them? How do you get them in a team? And to an extent, how do you stop the company getting rid of them? Because they will. Lots of them are being seen as walking on the margins of troublemaking.
Yeah, yeah.
So that's sort of the process that we tried to do. And as with your work, sometimes it's successful, sometimes it's not. But when it is, wonderful things can happen.
Yeah, no, that's really interesting. And I talk a lot, you know, my podcast is called Edgy Ideas, and it's about these people kind of who have that liminal capacity, who can kind of be at the edge. And you've talked about kind of four categories or four typologies of RNS, haven't you? Just tell us about those.
We looked at, and again, so I went into this. This is from literature and irony that's decades or centuries, even millennia old, that these different character types appear. And then you can also apply them to organizations. So one of them It's sort of the Apollonian or godlike ironist. So this is the stuff Nietzsche was talking about, in that the Apollonian sort of believes they sit above society in a very transcendental position. And from this objective, detached stance, perfectly and objectively sense makes what's going on. So they look down and say, oh, from my theory, my superior vantage and my superior viewpoint, I can perfectly explain the activities of everybody that I peer upon. That's the godlike Apollonian stance. You know, it's serene, it's objective, it's rational, etc.
These are my ex-colleagues in university business schools, so in the critical theory department.
Well, it's interesting because I know you use Latour. So Latour is one of the critiques of the people I use as a critique of this, Wilgar and Latour. Yeah. And they basically look, why don't we just ask people to tell stories? Because the person telling this serene, objective story, the story doesn't seem that interesting. You know, it becomes all full of jargon and cliches and things. So let's just find better stories. I mean, it can be done incredibly well, because I know you and I both read and love Kunda, and I think Kunda's work, he takes that role almost. He's doing it in a very, very sophisticated way, and it makes for a beautiful book. But I don't think he gets the other bits of irony, which is, so the ironist, he then identifies the ironist in the workplace. And he uses this identification to sort of damn engineered culture.
Yes.
So what he argues is that you have these characters who are ambivalent to the organization. So they both love and hate the work, they love and hate the culture, and they're playing around in that space. And he argues that what they do is irony, but it's a very, very limited form of irony he's talking about, which we entitle sarcastic irony. And the sarcastic iron, basically, when they're in the action, is very, very serious in the action. Okay, so they're just doing what they're told and compliant and doing this kind of work. And then they move off to the side. So we use the idea of the Greek chorus, the parabasis. So when you're watching a Greek play, you go from the main action and suddenly the chorus speaks.
Yes.
And starts poking fun at the idiocy of the players who don't really realize what is going on. So what happens with a sarcastic iron is when they're in the action, they're deeply serious about the work. They don't play and laugh and joke and do that kind of work. But then they go off to the side to some of the liminal spaces, and then they have these jokey, sarcastic conversations about what was going on, who's the idiot, et cetera, et cetera. So Kunda used that, saying, look, that people are acting out the cultural roles. It's very deliberate. So this is back to dramatic intelligence again. They're acting out the cultural roles. And then in the liminal space or the in-between space, they're poking fun at it as a psychic release.
Yeah.
So that's the sarcastic. And that was where Kunda stopped. So we looked at, so we said, well, they're doing more than that, because they're actually poking fun in the work, in the action as well. And so that took us into the character of the trickster ironist. So the trickster ironist is more like, you know, so if the Greek chorus is the sarcastic, the trickster ironist is Puck from A Midsummer's Night's Dream. It's the ironist that's deeply in the action and is using all kinds of tricks and witticisms and elegance and humour and stuff to stick things together. Mm-hmm. When everybody else is getting hot and bothered under the collar and taking things too seriously, and then the enthusiasm becomes almost pathological. You've got this character that's running around and poking and playing and reducing the tension and getting them to see different ways of solving things, etc. So that's what one of the things that we identified, and then that was what all the academics were pulling out of the research and what I had to explain. And then the final type is the wise ironist. So this is a bit more like Jeeves in the Jeeves and Wooster novels. So this is the one, the ironist that sort of sits behind a sort of almost a bumbling blank cipher hero, someone that's not as interesting or as intelligent as this wise one, and he's pulling the strings from behind. So he's actually got a little bit of a, you know, maybe a number of in the action figures, who are clustering around him or her, who, and then they go, oh, yeah, do this and do that and do the other. But they're much more difficult to find because they're in a sort of a side space behind the scenes. And only at the end, very often, are they revealed to have been pulling the strings all along. So there, we also found evidence of that. So they're the four different types that exist.
And would the wise RNS be a force for good and for deviance? Would they?
Well, they absolutely, and so could the trickster.
Yeah,
I mean, so there's no ethical judgment made on ironists, sort of the ironic role. They can be malevolent. They can be the. Take on the role of the scapegoat, the malevolent scapegoat, who's, you know, Iago, for example, in Othello, is a terrible, you know, ironic kind of character. That's always the thing with irony, is that it can always. So one of the wonderful quotes is that it's you sort of irony always has an edge, and you're never really sure. Whether the ironist is malevolent or benevolent, and so that, yeah, that what they tend to do is they negate the space. So basically, they you know, when there's absurdity somewhere, they will see the gap between the rhetoric and reality. Or, you know, if for me, when I'm talking about culture, there's always a gap between the rhetoric and the reality. Yeah. And when you're talking about change, there's a gap between the aspirations and achievement. Yeah. And they operate in that gap. Now, what they do in that gap is always a bit about closing it. But why they close it could be because they possess the devil's mark, or because they have a snorkel of sanity. So, you know, the devil's mark is, yeah, they're there for themselves and for nothing else. Or the snorkel of sanity is, well, how do we stop this absurdity overwhelming all of us and do something for the greater good? Most of the ethical work is arranged around Socrates, because he was the prototype ironist. And you're trying to explore the Socratic ironist to look at the ethical stance.
I'm seeing this in the workplace as you know, we have different language for to describe similar experiences. The in the workplace, these people often try and get conformed or marginalized or pushed out or used politically and then dumped. They're often kind of played by other leaders. And I mean, the work I do in Ecolleisure is to try and hold the space open so we can have these voices and they reveal what's hidden, they reveal what's covering the gaps. That they and that can be enlightening and threatening, of course. And like in the Kenyan work, we talk about the object petty covering a gap. So we're all terribly, terribly busy to cover the gap that actually we're not being very productive, and everyone's feeling kind of fragmented and alienated, you know. So once you reveal that, it's kind of a huge relief for people at one level, and a huge threat because they're exposed. And it's like working in that space, isn't it, to try and get some outcome from that revelation, which is actually good for people's well-being and for the organizational well-being.
Well, yeah, I mean, you're summing up the ironic dilemma is, yeah, the reason they're coping with all of this ambiguity and drama and stuff is they enjoy it. I mean, there's a joy in the in-between. There's a joy in the absurdity. They don't, you know, unlike many who move into the fragmented space, they don't see the absurdity and go, oh, my God, I can't deal with this. This is not the way the world should be. They expect it. So when it comes, they're ready to embrace it and play with it and do that and take joy in the fact that the world is not as expected. Mm. But at the same time, they get their heads cut off regularly. Yes. I mean, we're looking to, again, if I look at some of the ironists that I use as exemplars, I mean, Socrates didn't enjoy his last drink very well, very much. Cicero, murdered. Oscar Wilde, Reading Jail. Voltaire, exiled. Jonathan Swift, who's one of my favourites, sent to a parish in the middle of Ireland where he couldn't cause any more trouble. So there's all, again, this edge is always present. So what we're seeing in the workplace, for me, you can map it back for 2,500 years. It's always the way the people who are comfortable in the gap are treated. And the risk, they always open up space for transformation. which is so important now because we're absolutely in need of it. But they always risk getting their head cut off at the same time. You know, I same as you, I see them all the time in organizations. The aim is, if you've got a bit of power, is to try and protect them, because that's where they're so valuable.
That's right. Absolutely valuable. I mean, it's the other piece of work I do and refer to a lot is social movements, like on the edge, because change takes place in society led by marginal figures. You know, so marginal hippies tree hugging a few years ago and now become mainstream environmental kind of campaigners and politicians. So looking at kind of these edge walkers and edge players is a big part of this, I think, is about trying to kind of hear these voices and creating a space for these voices to tell us some truths. Was it Milton Friedman who said that you have to have a set of ideas waiting for a space to open? I think he kind of formulated some ideas about the free market, and then when there's a crisis, he was ready with the ideas and use them. I'm wondering if you think, you know, we're going through a huge change. I mean, you know it better than anyone living in Hong Kong. Are there a set of ideas which you could kind of refer to waiting to kind of be used in this kind of new space which is opening up?
I'm not sure they're ideas. Again, because I'm if I'm playing the ironist role, I don't have the ideas. I just have the ability to negate the current and open up the space where the ideas might manifest. I might have the ideas, and I might be the person that has the creative potential to come up with an answer. But my role is more to create spaces in which the ideas might manifest, so to be the transformational character. And I think I'm quite good at that. So some of the work that we do you talked about liminal space and the in-between space earlier. So what we think is going on at the moment is these spaces are being stripped away by COVID.
Yeah.
The chat that you would have had at the water cooler, or at the pre-work coffee, or the after-work drinks, or in Hong Kong over yum cha, for example, they've been lost. As is the time that you can have these chats via Zoom call, because Zoom calls are generally formal and set in stone in the calendar, and you've got very specific slots and et cetera, et cetera. So we're looking, well, how do you actually recreate liminality and in-betweenness when we're just using Zoom as a tool? How do you do it? How do you create transformational spaces where people from all over the world can get together to explore complex situations without being asked to find an answer, but being able to take the question very, very far. And so that's really, I mean, you know, the last year, that's what I've been working on. What do you call that?
Is that your...
So that's EQ Lab. Now we have to call... EQ doesn't stand for emotional intelligence. Intelligence, and of course we have to use EQ rather than XI for very obvious political reasons. So you know, if you're talking extended intelligence, people won't talk to you. People think they know what you mean when they say EQ lab, but then you say, well, yeah, not quite. So what we're trying to do is play around with the notions of extended intelligence and the idea that we're looking at, again, it's this shared consciousness. It's multiple brains working together on complex situations linked together in time and space by some form of technology. Now we have Zoom as the easiest one to use, but we have other technologies that we can use in terms of capturing narratives and things as required. We've always looked at it as in opposition to the singularity. So one of my real fears is digital Taylorism and the singularity and the machine, that all of the human elements of work get stripped away and replaced by machines, not just work, life.
Facebook gets you.
I've been to a couple of talks where the guy who coined the term the singularity was speaking, and I just didn't find it very impressive. I was like, you haven't really thought this through, have you? Our idea is the Star Trek future. And so the Star Trek future, of course, they're driven to explore brave new, strange new worlds and new civilizations, to boldly go where no one has ever gone before. So they're driven by the complex situation and the exploration. And they're also reliant on machinery. Mm-hmm. You know, the spaceship keeps them alive.
Yeah.
And also for me, specifically the original series, you've got Kirk as the in-betweenness. He's got two advisors. He's got the ultra-emotional McCoy and the ultra-rational Spock. And he's the in-between person trying to work out in all of this mess what the hell he has to do to solve the challenges that he's facing. So that we much prefer that future than the singularity, which is the Matrix and the Terminator and that kind of stuff. So that as a metaphor is what informs what we try to do. And without having a starship, with only having a network of computers and a Zoom, can we begin to go down this road of exploring all kinds of complex ideas with as many brains as possible?
And I think, you know, one thing I found in the work is that some people kind of reduce my work. I mean, eco leadership is problematic because eco symbolizes ecology to people, and they talk about how biology kind of informs our thinking about organizations. And there's a whole kind of piece of work on that. But I always kind of bring it back to, and technology. You know, this is not just kind of learning from lovely nature out there and importing it into our organizations so we can all be organic and sustainable. And it's actually really, how do we utilize technology within that ecosystem? We are cyborgs, we are hybrid, we are kind of all mixed up with this now. People, technology, environment, how does this kind of work together?
Yeah, I mean, I'm not the mathematician who deals with this. I think probably more than you do, we rely on complex adaptive systems. I mean, that's the science that we try to. So we have two basic premises. Is the future of work is understanding of complex adaptive systems and a deep, rich, and broad understanding of what it means to be human. And so the complex adaptive systems for me talks to both biology and to technology. Mm-hmm. You know, you can apply, and also, I mean, I've been very fortunate to work with a few people on indigenous wisdom, and it's the same patterns that they talk about
as the
complex adaptive systems. And you know, if I the occasional moment where I hear quantum theory and the bits I understand, it's very similar patterns. Yeah. So you've got something in that space that I find. You know, you can't go to a senior executive and say, you know, the answer is in indigenous wisdom. Mm. You can't go, it's in quantum physics. They're just going to look at you as if you're mad. But something around, if you say, look, it's about, you know, your organizations are a system. Yes, they get that. Your organizations need to be adaptive. Yeah, they get that. The word complex scares them.
Yes.
Because they want simplicity. But then you sort of look at, well, exploring the complex is just a bunch of simple ways to explore it. And if you know how to do that, then you're in a really interesting place. So to do that, you've got to create the environment in which multiple humans can come together and behave like humans. Do the kind of work that needs to be done. Rather than the assumption, again, going back to the beginning of what we talked about, these out-of-date and snake-oily kind of theories, which the organizations are relying on to say what humans should be doing in the workplace.
Yeah. I mean, I don't use complex adaptive systems much. I mean, I'd note that kind of eco-leadership and ecosystems is informed by quantum physics is one of the kind of key game changers and pay some attention. Like, I'm not a mathematician, so... You know, I'm on the very margins of that, but I understand that something's important there, absolutely, and it informs us. Complex adaptive systems, in my experience, is interesting, but I haven't found many people who've managed to kind of bridge it into the workplace, and I haven't myself. You know, that's like where I struggle with it.
I mean, so one of my ongoing projects with someone called John Dobbin is how do we make the language of complex adaptive systems intelligible to business people, and we've had a little bit of success with a couple of clients. So it's sort of a two-step process because he understands the maths and he interprets it into something that I understand, and then I take the interpretation level.
Yeah.
So that's been, and again, it's pretty informal. We don't have a huge amount of time to do it, but when we do, it's hugely enjoyable. And I'm beginning to get it to a point where you can sort of go to, and like I said, we've done it with a big financial institution where the head of HR was absolutely panicky that this was too much theory for people in financial services. Yeah. And but it resonated because they saw we'd managed to get the language to something that they understood, and they went, yeah, okay, this makes a lot of sense to us. But at the same time, saying to them, look, whilst this is great, recognize you can only do it in bits of the organization. We can't just go, right, the whole organization needs to look like that. Bring the bits that need this kind of thinking and play around with them. And if they work, then move it into other parts of the organization. So that we were very clear, we're not.
This is not a top-down change program.
Yeah. We're not saying change everything at once because that's too dangerous. We're saying find the places where it might work and have a play now you understand it.
What I find with the ecosystem work is the same, is that I find that if, you know, people have this imagination that, you know, they still have hierarchies in their mind and they still have kind of top-down change in their mind, you know, develop a strategy, like do the operations, carry it out. And I say the beauty of the kind of the ecosystem work is to, and networks and complex adaptive systems is to find clusters of people, find nodes, connect nodes and clusters, small change leads to big change, and it manifests in a very different way. And that actually liberates people a lot because they get kind of their shoulders drop a bit. They don't feel like they've got to change the whole culture all at once. And you get like these players, these RNS, these people together, these mathematicians, these people who can think differently in liminal spaces, and they create a kind of a node of change, which then kind of creates a kind of viral spread throughout the organization in a rhizomatic kind of way. That I think that's very, very helpful for people.
Absolutely, that's exactly what we try to do. We try and give them the tools to play around at the edges.
Yeah.
And again, with this financial client, and they were talking about, oh, I've just discovered this bit of the organization that I didn't know that existed. And yes, I can see space, you know, the opportunities for us to work with them. So people make instant connections. Oh, yeah, that would be how we could work with them. There's something you can see the brain working when you start pushing these. Yeah, they just find the clusters, just find the possibilities to do some cross-disciplinary work here. It's not going to risk loads and loads of money, but it might be the beginnings of a change that's necessary for your well-being and your team's well-being, or a change that can help the organization be more, can contribute more to sustainability, which they want to be able to do, or improve the bottom line or whatever it is. Yeah. It all starts with these little small experiments that appear in these clusters of people who are sort of willing to have a go.
We're coming to the end. It's been really fascinating talking to you. I like to ask my guests a question at the end about how we live the good life and how to create a good society. Have you got any thoughts at all to share with our audience?
I mean, it's a tough question, but living the good life. So I think COVID has brought home to us that the good life requires human connection, both at work and locally, and you know we need to regain that, not just for our own personal well-being, but actually to combine to people to form solutions that have societal impact. So we need to put connection back at the heart of the human and the workplace experience. And part of that connection and part of what we do is weirdly, and I keep on going back into this metaphor, it's regaining the lost art of the dinner party. Mm-hmm. You know, it's the conversations that I most miss, or I most missed because COVID is not so bad at the moment, so we can have them again. But the conversations that I most missed were the kind of conversations that you had with maybe 4 to 6 other people around a dinner table after the second glass of red wine. Mm-hmm. Because you've then, you know, people have very often at these dinner parties, people have, you know, somewhat the host curated them. He's brought people together to you'll get on well with you. But before that second glass of red, it's a little bit stilted. And sort of, you know, halfway through that second glass of red, you're beginning to see conversations flow. You're beginning to see meaning and connections happen between people. But also what you're getting is you're actually getting learning, and learning in the terms of you're in this conversation, but you're half hearing that conversation, and you break off and you go to that one. Yes, and so there's this kind of messiness and interruption in not in the interruption and distraction of a screen bleeping at you and going, oh, I've got a message.
Yeah.
But a very human messiness and interaction and interruption and distraction where you're learning and interacting and doing stuff. So I'm not saying we have to reinvent the dinner party, because not everyone wants to go to dinner parties and drink glasses of red wine.
No.
But that's the good life. Something akin to that, in a way that suits you and the people that you that are close to you, is what we create. And then if we can do that, and we can have organizations that also internally enable things a bit like that, we're not going to be in a bad space, I don't think.
Well, the good society will emerge. Richard, it's been fantastic talking to you. Really enjoyed it. You go well.
Thank you. Great fun.
Thank you for listening to Edgy Ideas. If you enjoyed our podcast and would like further information about our coach and leadership training, or would like to join our advanced community of practice where we discuss edgy ideas and much, much more, please contact me, Simon@analyticnetwork.com.